If you're listening to this, then you likely already know that being an independent musician can be a lonely road. And maybe your friends and your family just don't fully understand why you do what you do or why you invest so much time, energy, and money towards achieving your music goals. And especially early on, it can be hard to find people who really understand what you're trying to accomplish and how to make it happen. So that's where Modern Musician comes in. My name is Michael Walker, and you know, I can understand and relate to that feeling. I've been there myself, and so has our team of independent artists. And the truth is that basically everything good in my life has been the result of music. It's the reason I met my wife. It's why I have my three kids. It's how I met my best friends. And now with Modern Musician, we've seen so many talented artists who started out with a dream, with a passion, but without really a fan base, without a business, and be able to take that and turn it into a sustainable full-time career and be able to impact hundreds of thousands, even millions of fans with their music. And we've had thousands of messages from artists who've told us that we've helped change their lives forever. And it just gets even more exciting, fulfilling when you're surrounded by a community of other people who get it and who share their success and their knowledge with each other openly. And so if you are feeling called to make your music a full-time career and to be able to reach more people with your music, then I want to invite you to join our community so that we can support your growth and help lift you up as you pursue your musical dreams. You'll be able to interact in a community with other high-level artists, coaches, and industry professionals, as well as be able to participate in our daily live podcasts, meet these amazing guests, and get access to completely free training. If you'd like to join our family of artists who truly care about your success, then click on the link in the show notes and sign up now.
Artists are relying on social media in order to develop a fan base, in order to develop that direct, what they think is a direct relationship with their fans. However, it's not a direct relationship with their fans because they do not own the data.
Welcome to the Modern Musician Podcast, where each week I help you turn your passion for making music into a profitable career. This is all about you discovering and expressing who you really are so that you can build a loyal fan base that truly resonates with you and with your music. You can impact more people with your artwork. I'm your host, Michael Walker, and let's get into it.
All right. I'm excited to be here today with my new friend, Mark Meharry. Mark, gosh, you know, I made the cardinal mistake, Mark. Before we get started, I'll reintroduce you. I just want to double check and make sure. Am I pronouncing your name correctly? Is it Mark Meharry?
Yes, that's absolutely correct.
Got it? Okay, good. Usually I remember to check it beforehand, but I'll do that one more time. 3, 2, 1. Yeah! All right. I'm excited to be here today with my new friend, Mark Meharry. Mark is the founder and CEO of Music Glue, which is the go-to direct-to-fan platform used by artists like Metallica and Lauf to sell merch, music, and tickets worldwide. He's an advocate for artist autonomy and ownership, and that's why they've created this tool that allows artists to actually retain control over their brand, data, and revenue. He has over 20 years of experience at the intersection of tech and music. He helps guide artists through the shift from the traditional legacy model of the music industry to fan-first strategies. So, man, that is just awesome. I mean, this is where my world and my heart is at right now. So it's so awesome to see what you've built to help artists connect with their fans. So excited to have him on the podcast today to talk a little bit about owning the connection and how to, as an artist, build a stronger relationship with your fans directly. So, Mark, thank you so much for taking the time to be on the podcast today.
Cool. I'm very happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So maybe to kick things off, could you share just a little bit about your story and how you came to build this software tool and work with artists like Metallica and Lauf?
Yeah, sure. So I'm actually from New Zealand originally, so I'm not from the UK. And I studied architecture, and so I'm an architect of all things. And going through architecture school in Auckland, I formed a band with a group of other musicians that were also doing architecture and fine arts. And we used to play at a local Irish pub and make our money in order to get through university doing that. I eventually left New Zealand and came to the UK in 1999, and that band continued on, and they actually ended up getting signed to Universal and asked me if I'd like to be their manager, their international manager. In America, you wouldn't have heard of the band, but in New Zealand, they were multi-platinum. They were huge. So everyone over there knows them. They're world famous in New Zealand. And they didn't even replace me. I was the bass player, and the keyboard player just started playing all my bass lines with his left hand. And that's how important I was to the band. So definitely failed musician, came to the UK. I was working on Y2K projects. If you remember back in the pre-2000 days, all the planes were going to fall out of the sky as soon as the year 2000 hit. So I was working on those sort of projects. And I won't go into detail, but I ended up working at PwC, of all places, working on SAP. So I became a finance systems implementation manager, which I absolutely hated. I hated my day job. That was not me at all. I was still playing in bands, managing this band from New Zealand, and I actually ended up quitting my job. I just couldn't do it. I was not designed for wearing suits at all. And especially if you know, going out, spending all night in Camden, which in those days was sort of the center of the European music industry, live music industry, spending all night, you know, spending nights drinking with Amy Winehouse and then going to work at 8 o'clock in the morning when you're dealing with people that have been at the gym since 6 o'clock. It just didn't work. And so I quit my job and I ended up working for a company that was building the Robbie Williams online store. So this is 2003, 2004, which is the idea of selling directly was a brand new concept and no one had really been doing it. Robbie Williams is a big pop artist in the UK, needed an international store. And so I worked for the company that was building that out. And I thought, what if we had made this available for everybody? Every artist on the planet should be able to do this. There are a few companies that were doing similar sort of things. But I put a business plan together. 2006, founded the company. 2007, we got funding and off we went. And the idea from the start was an artist should be able to sell everything. It's not just your digital music, but your merchandise, your physical music, and your tickets. So absolutely every single thing that you possibly have to sell, you should be able to sell directly to your fans, because at the end of the day, the world at that point was changing to where artists were beginning to do marketing themselves. And you've got to remember, we're coming out of a world where music was distributed by CDs. And if you wanted to find out about a new artist, you basically read about them on through magazines, or you heard about them on the radio, or you saw them on MTV. So very controlled channels to market, which were all being blown apart. Napster had just hit. I mean, Kazaa and LimeWire were beginning to become prevalent as well. And so the music industry was in a tailspin at that point. So we came in and said, okay, well, look, artists, I mean, this is before Facebook. This is pre-Facebook. This is MySpace was just starting to take off. And the whole concept of an artist releasing recording music in their bedroom and releasing it via social media direct to fan was a completely brand new concept. And so we were very early in and got on board with that concept and drove a lot of that democratization, I guess, of the music industry was where we were coming at. Now and over time, obviously we've grown as a business. It's been a long road. And as you mentioned earlier, yeah, we do the e-commerce for Metallica outside of North America, and Pearl Jam outside of North America, AC/DC worldwide, Led Zeppelin worldwide, Iron Maiden worldwide. So some really big names. And our business model has shifted slightly as we've moved along. But that was never the intention. The intention was making tools available for independent artists at a price that they could afford. And in fact, when we came up with our first pricing model, the argument we had was, if we had to have a conversation with Metallica, what would the price be that we would offer Metallica? What would be the price that we'd actually be squeezed down to that we could then offer Metallica? And that's the price we're going to offer to everybody, because it's not fair that a band like Metallica gets a better price than any other artist. So we've always stuck with that. We don't have any tiered pricing based on the size of the artist. It's just that is the price. And whether you're an emerging artist or whether you're an established artist, you get exactly the same price cut. So that's the very brief from zero to where we are.
Cool. Man, rock on. I mean, especially everything that I've heard about Metallica. Yeah, we have a client who loves Metallica and also is like, you know, connected with them. And from everything I've heard, like, they're really smart. They're really smart with their marketing. Like, they're great with connecting with their fans. So that makes a lot of sense that they have this relationship with a platform like yours that helps them to actually connect directly with their community and to own the audience. So I'm curious to hear your perspective on mean, this is amazing that like, to me, it sounds like you're so ahead of the curve in terms of like right now, like even at the time of recording this, like a decade or more later, it still feels like there's a huge gap between like many of the artists and their fans with platforms like Spotify, where you can't actually see who your fans are and you can't connect with them or message them or own the list. Many of the ticketing platforms, you can't see, like you can't run ads to it because you can't see like who purchased. Like you're like, you have no idea. It's so like, to me, it feels so backwards. So I'm curious to hear like your perspective on the greater movement of the music industry right now. And you know, how a platform like what you've built sort of connects with some of these like massive players that are still like kind of gatekeeping a lot of the actual access to like fan data from the artists.
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge problem, and it's a problem that's actually getting worse. And I think through the pandemic was one of the first times when I think artists really started to understand how important that direct access is, and having the ability to contact their fans directly. And those that had built up a database over the years were the ones that actually benefited massively during that period. And but coming out of the pandemic, there's a lot of nervousness in the market, and we're certainly in Europe, things have changed massively. And what we're seeing now is that artists are relying on social media in order to develop a fan base, in order to develop that direct, what they think is a direct relationship with their fans. However, it's not a direct relationship with their fans because they do not own the data. And if you want to even communicate with your fan base, it's going to cost you a lot of money, because if you want to have your post sitting at the top of any of your fans' feeds, then you have to pay for that because you're competing with other marketers. So it is not your data. It is not a way. And even as we've seen recently, companies are being blocked in certain countries. So certainly in America, depending on whatever political movement is happening at the time, a particular social media site could be blocked. And if you've built your entire fan base using that particular site, then you've actually been restricted from having access to your fans. So we still, and I know that having an email database, a CRM database based on email addresses, is very old school, and it's sort of seen as, you know, last decade kind of technology. However, it does actually work. And we see this time and again, artists that actually have built up a database where they're contacting their fans directly benefit from it massively. And we work with a lot of smaller artists that even in the US, I don't think you would have even heard of them. And one particular artist I can talk about, because their manager is a friend of mine, we've known these guys for a long time, is a band called Enter Shikari. And for the listeners, if you've not heard of this band, check them out. They play arenas in the UK. When they go on sale with tickets, they typically do about 20 to 30% of the houses through their Music Glue store, so that they've got control over that ticketing. And they were one of the biggest selling artists during the pandemic, because they've got a direct relationship with their fan base. They make fantastic merchandise, they make fantastic music, and yet people have not necessarily heard of them. So they've got this hardcore set of fans that will buy everything that they release, and they connect with them directly, and they make money from this. I mean, these guys, you know, it's four guys in the band who are in their mid-30s, that are married with children, that have their houses paid for, and are playing rock music. I mean, but they don't care about being on the radio. And in fact, they haven't been on the radio. They don't care at all about the media side of things. They've got a long-term career, sustainable career, with a fan base that support them financially, and will continue to do so for a very long time. And that's kind of where our model always sat, with, you know, that sort of artist. And one of the important points there was ticketing. And there's a certain amount of data that you, in order to build up a database, if you stick a, hey, join my mailing list on any social media site, no one's going to join your mailing list. You can stick a join my mailing list on your website, no one's going to join your mailing list. The way you build up a database is you've got to sell stuff to people. And when you sell stuff to people, then you get their address and you get their information, and then you can contact them. And that means also that somebody who's really engaged with what you're doing. And so there's a certain amount you can get from selling merchandise and physical music. Very difficult to sell digital content these days because it's all available for free. But there's a massive delta when you get up to ticketing. If you put a tour on sale where you're doing the advanced tickets and you're doing, even if you're an emerging artist and you're doing 10 to 20% of the house, that is a lot more data than you're ever going to make from selling merchandise or selling physical, selling vinyl. And for the artists that do that, then the ticket, the companies that they're working with, the promoters understand that that's actually important for the artist. And, but you have to ask. And this is very, very important. If you want to get tickets to sell directly to your fan base, even if it's a 48-hour window before anyone else goes on sale, however, and whatever, however you want to structure this, you have to ask upfront. And there might be a bit of push and shove, and promoters don't want to give those tickets over. And you've got to ask the reason is why do they not want to hand over tickets? And it's because they're making a kickback. Typically, there are, you know, things happening in the background, where all this money that's being added onto the top of the ticket price, that all gets shuffled to the venues, to the promoters, to the, all sorts of people get a piece of that. And so push back on that. And in the early days, we worked with, I think the biggest band that we worked with on ticketing was Mumford & Sons. And so we worked with them from the very, very beginning. I mean, when we first started out the company, we used to put on a little night in North London, and one night, like a little showcase night for the bands that we worked with. And one night we had Mumford & Sons were headlining, and then it was Laura Marling was supporting them, and then a guy called JJ Pistolet, who's now Jay, is the lead singer of The Vaccines. And they played in front of 30 people at a little venue where I had my own PA system, and I was the sound engineer and put this thing on. But Mumford & Sons got what we were doing and totally understood the model. And to the point where they were booked to play a festival in London called Wireless Festival. Now, this is back 2013, 60,000 capacity show that they were playing. And they insisted that they did all the tickets. And this is a Live Nation event. And they said, we're doing 100% of the tickets or you're not booking us. So that's the sort of stuff that we, and they had the muscle to do it. So it just requires the push and shove, but it is really, really, I think fundamentally important for all artists. They're playing live shows and they have the ability to sell advanced tickets, is to insist that they get an allocation of tickets, because then they will find out who their hardcore fans are. They will find out the location of the fan. They'll have their email address. And next time you go back and play, you can contact them and you can do the marketing directly to them. That's exactly how these bands that we've worked with have done it over the years, is build the database. Everyone has an email address that their granny can contact them by. Everyone who signs up to social media platforms has an email address. And they might not check it every day, but they will check it, and you will be able to contact them. And at least you do have that direct relationship if you have an email address. Sorry, I'll bang on all day about the email address, but that is still the best way to contact people directly.
Mm. That's super helpful. No, I appreciate it. Feel free to bang on about it because it's true. You know, it's a fundamental thing, and it does seem like it's so weird how little attention it gets when, like, comparatively, you know, there's so much more upside to the email. I guess it kind of makes sense because it's more underground, right? So it's not like as flashy, like people can't see it on the surface. It's not like people are walking around with a sign on their social media profile saying, I have this many email subscribers. But everyone has like that kind of sign with their social media following. It kind of makes them feel better. But it sounds like what you're saying is that really, you know, these social media platforms are, you know, a powerful way to, you know, get in front of an audience, but you don't necessarily own that audience. Like MySpace, where the platform is huge, but you know, when the platform, if the platform dies, you lose access, then your whole business could die. And so what you found through connecting with artists like Mumford & Sons from the ground up is that they understood at a deep level the importance of connecting, you know, with their fans and owning that actual relationship. And really inspiring to hear too, the stories of, you know, you have to ask for access. You know, when you're booking these shows, if you don't ask, then often, like, you know, you won't have access to that audience. Okay. So In terms of one final thing that you had mentioned that I thought was interesting was in terms of how you build your email list. And it sounded like what you were recommending was one of the best ways to build your email list is to actually like sell things to those people. And therefore, when you sell something, like you'll get their contact info. And not just that, but you know that it's like a high quality contact to have because they actually bought something from you. I'm curious, you coming from the digital marketing world, you know, there's the concept of lead magnets and having like free gifts and kind of like the things that you give away in exchange for someone joining. And I 100% agree that at least like saying like, just join my mailing list. Like why? Like that's not valuable to me at all. But I'm curious, like, do you think there's a place for like free gifts or unlocking things or what do you recommend just from experience that no, like you can do that, but it's actually probably better leverage just to like focus on offering something for sale because you're going to get like a better quality lead from it.
I mean, when we first started out, even the reason we came up with the name Music Glue was because our original model was give away your digital content because it's available anyways, but give it away in return for an email address. So we'd have the, you know, get my MP3 album. You can have it for free, but I want the email address. And with that email address, then you can get back to that fan and say, hey, well, if you like that, then you might be interested in buying something. Hey, I'm a struggling musician. And that was all well and good in the early days because people wanted to download MP3s. That is not the case anymore, and no one's going to do that. So digital content becomes very difficult. Even giving it away in return for data is a very, very difficult thing to do. So then you're getting into physical content, which becomes expensive. You don't want to be giving that away because, delivery services are so expensive. Even if you've got something that's very cheap, even if it's just a badge or a pin or something you can put in an envelope, it's still going to cost you some money. So, what we tend to suggest to people is, and it depends on which level of artist you're dealing with. When you're first starting out, it's very, very tough. Once you get to a certain level, we do a fan club system, and we built this originally for Iron Maiden. So we essentially run the Iron Maiden fan club, which is £15 a year. And you get you get online magazines. So exclusive content. You can join the forum and you get 48 hour, access to tickets when they go on sale for all of their shows, which is the big draw card, by the way, for a band of that size. And so, yeah, various bits and pieces of digital things that are exclusive to members of the fan club. So we find that works well. I mean, even the band I mentioned earlier, Enter Shikari, they have a fan club and they have, you know, a locked area on their website, which you can only access. It has, you know, specific content, photos when they're being, you know, when they're playing shows, that sort of thing. So sort of interesting content that might be of interest. And if you price it correctly, so, you know, when I say £15, so $20 a year to join a fan club for a band like Iron Maiden is actually pretty good value. I mean, it's, you know, for what you get from it. And it's still not a big hassle for the band to prepare the content and make the things available. But they're also not posting things out. So they're saving money on that side. Enter Shikari do post out a magazine once a year to all of the fans as part of their fan club. So it's that, how do you make it slightly more palatable? And there's a lot of debate. We've been involved in this debate over the years as to whether it's a good look for an artist to be putting their hand out and saying, oh, join my fan club and pay some money. So you've really got to message it in a very specific way. And then it does work. If it's the, hey, we really need some money, that's not a good look. Don't go down that road. If it's, hey, I'm going to give you something I'm going to give you exclusive stuff that no one else can have, but you just have to pay a small amount of money in order to get that exclusive content, then that becomes actually interesting for fans and they will engage with that. And if you can throw in something, you know, if you can afford to be posting them something, they absolutely love that. It's, you know, as I say, for Enter Shikari, they send a magazine once a year, the Enter Shikari magazine, which looks absolutely fantastic and fans really, you know, really love it. Iron Maiden used to have a t-shirt. When you signed up for the fan club, they would send you a t-shirt, which is a fan club exclusive t-shirt, which when you went to the Iron Maiden gigs, and Iron Maiden's really strange. When I say this, that if you've never been to an Iron Maiden show, you may not believe what I'm about to say, but it is 100% true is that everybody at an Iron Maiden show, including a number of the band members, wear Iron Maiden t-shirts. And this is the unwritten rule. You never wear the t-shirt of the band that you're seeing when you go to a gig, unless it's Iron Maiden. And then everyone wears an Iron Maiden. The first Iron Maiden gig I went to, I turned up in a Metallica t-shirt, and the manager of Iron Maiden came roaring across the pre-show party, grabbed me, said, "What the hell is that?" And he basically grabbed the t-shirt from the merch desk and said, "Stats on." So, okay, I don't know what the rules were. I do now. I do know now. But anyway, so fans used to turn up with their, because this fan club t-shirt also had on the back what year it was that they joined the fan club. And you'd stand watching this gig, and you'd see on the back of all these shirts were the fans that were members of the fan club, and they were so proud. And the ones that the proudest ones were the ones that had the earliest date on, that had been members of the fan club the longest. And that's loyal fandom. And they will, you know, these are the guys that every time a new t-shirt comes out, they'll buy it. They'll, you know, whatever comes through on the merch side of things, they want it, they collect it. If you go to their houses, it's just Iron Maiden everywhere. They love it. And for every artist, there are those fans. It's just, how do you find them? How do you tap into them? And depending on the genre of music that you're working with as well, how do you engage with them and provide things that they want? But they will want it at a certain, when you get to a certain level, they want to engage, because at the end of the day, it's art. You know, where you're creating as an artist, you're creating something that touches people emotionally. And as a result of that, they feel good. They feel happy. And they want to give something back, and they want more. And what are the things, depending on exactly the type of music that you're creating, is what is it that you can do to provide that? Because there's definitely demand. It's then how to work out how to provide the supply. And as I say, it's like, yeah, fan clubs that you sign up to. Even for some of the artists that we work with, you don't pay to join the fan club. They have a tier, which is the free tier. Join the fan club and you get some exclusive stuff. Because again, at the end of the day, that data, that email address and the location of that fan is invaluable. And it becomes invaluable when you start plotting tours. If you want to come to Europe as an American artist and you've spent 2 years of building up a database of giving content away to European fans, then you can actually plot your tour. And you might think, you know what? I'm not going to play in Cologne because I don't have any fans in Cologne. But in Stuttgart, I've got 5 fans that I can contact. So we'll do a gig in Stuttgart. But you won't know that, and you won't be able to contact them unless you've actually got this database. And so it's how to provide content that works for your fan base, that people will engage with, and that you can then get that data together and provide information. And then, as I mentioned earlier, then with ticketing, if you're talking to a local German promoter and you say, I've actually got 400 email addresses of German customers that I've got direct access to, it's a very different conversation than talking to a German promoter and saying, I don't know, I've got some fans on Facebook, I think in Germany, but I'm not really sure. I guess I can contact them. It's a very, very different conversation if you say, okay, I've got direct access to them and I can send them an email and I want tickets and I want to sell them directly.
Super smart. Love the idea of the t-shirts with the year that they join on the back, and like honoring the people that were kind of the early adopters. It sounds like, you know, one of the things that you're pointing to with the artists is that it's like the community. Like the community is a extremely valuable thing to be a part of. And like music in general, it's like, I mean, maybe that's one of, if not the most valuable parts of what we do as artists, is like we create community, we bring people together. So if you can honor and shine a light on fans who've been there since the beginning, that's a really valuable thing. It's being recognized is something that they get validation from. It's something that is truly valuable to them. It's not necessarily a begging, you know, them to support you. It's something you can truly provide as like a service to the community. I'm curious, in terms of, you know, you have a lot of perspective and experience having witnessed this major evolution from the first ever like direct to fan connections or the direct to fan channels that got opened up. At the time of us recording this right now, it feels like we're kind of in the midst of another major revolution in a few different areas, but specifically in terms of like AI is a big one that's kind of opening up what's possible as a creative. Lots of controversy and kind of fear around what does this mean for our role as artists. As someone who's sort of witnessed major shifts in the music industry from different mediums of, you know, what used to be an asset with like CDs and now, I mean, obviously like also there's a vinyls are kind of making a comeback, but the point being that there's been major shifts that you've seen come and go, different waves. This is a major wave that we're experiencing right now. Maybe one of, if not like the biggest waves we've ever experienced with this new form of digital intelligence. How do you view the role of a music artist in a post AI world where, you know, people do have the ability to generate artwork faster? How would you recommend that artists are listening to this right now calibrate and sort of align with these new technologies without getting overwhelmed or drowning?
I mean, it's a very good question and one that, you know, I spend, I don't know, two lunches a week with managers of bands, including the, you know, the big ones that we work with. And so this comes up all the time. I mean, they are, when you're dealing with bands, you know, the scale of Iron Maiden, AI is a huge concern to them. Because they're being ripped off the whole time. I mean, this is an iconic brand that is now being used. You know, you can even with AI systems say, you know, create me an album cover in the style of Iron Maiden for my band, and they will come up with something that looks really cool. And it's terrifying. And so in a lot of copyright breach. But at the end of the day, they're playing a game of whack-a-mole trying to keep on top of this. And it's not going to slow down. For emerging artists, I mean, I think we're going through a phase now of where pop is actually fairly dominant. And certainly in Europe, there's a lot of pop coming through. And feels quite manufactured, almost like back in the late 80s kind of style of manufactured pop music. I think part of that is down to the way the record companies are operating. There's a lot less live music scene in the UK at the moment than it has been for a long time. A lot of the venues are closing down. There's the Gen Zs are not going out to watch live music like the previous generations did. But I think that's going to swing around. At the end of the day, music is an art form, and there's going to be probably a swing back to the live performance and the importance of the live performance. And I've always, you know, always been a big advocate of perfecting your art, not just from a recording perspective, but from a live performance perspective. And I think, you know, the cream always rises to the top. These, you know, I can go on and on about, but the cream will rise to the top. And if you're absolutely brilliant and awesome and can put on a fantastic live show, that touches people in a way that you cannot do through recordings. And so how do you navigate the world of modern technology and AI is, well, you can't AI a really fantastic live performance that requires a human being standing on stage and engaging emotionally with an audience. And there's nothing that can replace that. And so focus on that side of things and get that absolutely perfect. And, you know, we've worked with a lot of emerging artists over the years, and a lot of people have this sort of, you know, wake up one day and think, oh, I'm going to be a musician. This is great. And then they can record some stuff in their bedroom and, you know, they get out GarageBand and they make some noises, and then they put it on Spotify and nobody listens to it. And they're trying to wonder what's going on. It's like, well, if you woke up one morning and decided that you wanted to be a professional football player, you can't do it. It takes a decade. It's, you know, it's not something that you can just suddenly decide you want to do. And so don't be disheartened and dispirited if it doesn't work out initially, because it probably would never. You've got to hone your craft. And it is a craft, and it requires an enormous amount of work. And when you see the artists that do pop up, certainly in the UK, the ones that really shine through, the amount of hours that they've put in to their craft is absolutely phenomenal. I mean, these are proper musicians that actually know what they're doing, and they do shine through. And it, yeah, focus, stick to it, but work hard. And you know, it's the old 10,000 hours kind of rule really does apply to music. You need to have done 10,000 hours of actually honing your craft before really you're going to be any good. it's just the way it is. So how do you deal with AI? Be awesome. Just be awesome and really work at it. And no AI can replace that. It still requires a human being. AI just takes things from the internet and munges it together and comes up with something that's, you know, okay, all creativity and all art is derivative. There's never an original idea. I mean, but AI really is not an original idea. It just munges stuff together and comes up with something that kind of looks good and sounds okay, but it's not the same as a human being that actually takes an idea and then processes it through the human process with 10,000 hours of experience and performance playing, and then comes up with something that's slightly different and an improved version. That's a real skill. So focus on that. Is that a different response than other people have given?
I love hearing people's response to this. I would say that the pattern that I hear, very grateful to, at this point, like, get to surround myself with people like yourself who are smarter than I am in different areas of the music industry and who have like a very experienced perception of what's happening. Yeah, I think if you ask the average bystander, like, most of them would probably be a lot more afraid of AI. And often I'll have conversations with like artists or with someone that's maybe more, has less like wider perspective, who are like concerned about losing, like being replaced by AI, I guess. And I absolutely understand the concern, because it's valid that, you know, like, we have some stuff to figure out in terms of the ethics of the training data and how this happens. Also, like you said, everything is derivative to a certain extent. So like, where do we draw the line of what's original versus a copywritten? But I would say in general, what I hear is similar to what you're describing, looking at these as tools to extend our creative capabilities, but ultimately like not replacing that spark or that humanness or whatever you want to call it, that like the thing that we're channeling when we're being creative and like putting it out, like there is something almost transcendent about where that comes from. And that's the thing that we want to kind of channel or unlock. And these tools can be used in a way that accelerates that, but doesn't necessarily replace it. I would say that's like the general sense that I get. And I view it the same way. I just don't know like where things are. I mean, I'm like a geek for things like The Singularity and the book by Ray Kurzweil, The Singularity is Near and Nearer. I watch a lot of news about the new AI tools and where things are headed. And it certainly feels like there's something unique about this specific, you know, era of technology in a way that might be different from what it's been in the past. Like I get the case of, you know, like drum machines and digital, like analog to digital, like these are all tools that help us to, you know, sort of like express ourselves better. Maybe for the first time ever, there's actually like a greater form of intelligence that we're creating with AGI or with super intelligence that, this is very like theoretical, but, if it stays exponential, then it's like, I don't know, it's just hard to, it's like that asymptote where it's like hard to predict where we're going to be at 2044. But I'm hopeful that humanity will like, you know, come along for the ride and that we'll have something like a Neuralink that helps us to like, you know, interface with it. I had a conversation with Noland Arbaugh a few months ago, who was the first human patient that got a Neuralink installed. So he's quadriplegic, paralyzed from the neck down. But on the podcast, he used his Neuralink to create a song telepathically using his thoughts and AI. And that was like a eye-opening experience for me, just kind of thinking through like, what are the implications of this 10 or 20 years from now? What if we could communicate with each other telepathically and we could dream up an idea for a song and just have it materialize like in front of us. I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen in that world.
I mean, everything you're saying is, I think that's the direction it's going, whether or not that will have the emotional impact that music that's created by a human being will have. We don't know. You mentioned a few different things there. One of which is, you know, how you actually consume content and at the end of the day, it's just neurons. It's just electrical charges in your brain. So you can get straight in and make that happen. But I don't think we know enough about emotions and the human, what is the human emotion? And why is it that when you listen to a certain song, you start crying? What causes that? And we may not ever know. I mean, because there's one thing is artificial intelligence, but emotional intelligence is a whole different thing. So how that? I mean, and, you know, it, as I say, it's for me. I listen to a lot of music. I've got a big vinyl collection. That's how I listen to music. I'm definitely going back to analog. I've cancelled a lot of my subscription services. This isn't a little bit of a protest, by the way, to what a certain president is doing worldwide with tariffs. So there's a lot of us in a particular creative communities that have cancelled everything at the moment until these things reverse. So I don't even have a Spotify account anymore. So I'm completely disconnected, and I'm very happy with this. It's like, you know what? If I want to listen to music, I'm going to put my vinyl on. That's how I listen to music. Mm. And if I want to really engage emotionally, I'm going to go to a live show. And it's lucky for me living in London. It's easy to go, you know, to get to a lot of gigs very easily. That's how I consume music. And I just wonder if there's going to be a backlash. And music's always been about punk rock. It's, you know, it's always the audience pushed back. And so if technology goes too far in one direction, I can bet you that there'll be a massive backlash, and then suddenly it'll go in the other direction, and it'll be, yeah, definitely back to vinyl and going to gigs and wanting to see musicians playing musical instruments and not laptops, and that sort of thing will start coming back, and then it'll swing the other direction, and it'll, you know, it's back and forth. I mean, we went through a big dance phase here in Europe in the late 90s, and then it became indie music, and it was all about skinny jeans and guys playing guitars, and so now that's not cool anymore, but that will become cool again, and who knows, it'll just swings and roundabouts, and it's whatever is cool with the new generation that come through that have to do exactly the opposite of what their parents did is always going to be whatever the new cool thing is. And so who knows which direction that's going to go. So at the moment, I agree. I think the tech side of things, I mean, we're going to go through quite a phase with this, but then the next generation are going to go, oh, that's so boring. That's what my parents did. I'm going in the other way. Who knows? If we could predict this, if I could predict this, I'd be a wealthy man, and I'm not.
we need more compute. We need more tokens to accurately predict the next word. I love this conversation. I think this is like one of my favorite things to talk about and think about. And I totally agree with what you're saying in terms of like, I feel like most people can feel it, right? That just like there's this tension or the amount of dependence that we have on social media and technology feels like it's sort of it's distracting us or removing us from our roots or like grounding us as humans and as like, you know, or beings. Like when we go out in nature, like it's this amazing, like transcendent experience. That's, you know, sort of like it on the opposite end of what we feel with technology and being like plugged in. So I feel like most of us can relate to that and kind of feel that while also having mixed feelings because, you know, we also depend on these technologies and in many ways it's like, you know, better than it's ever been in terms of what like poverty is used to be like 80 or 90% of the world and now it's like 10% or something and it's going down. Even though it feels like it's getting worse, it's like actually like overall things are trending in a good direction. But Yeah. I mean, gosh, I think about this sometimes with my kids. I've got a 7-year-old, a 5-year-old, and a 3-year-old. And I think about them like when they're teenagers. And if they put me through half of what I put my parents through when I was a teenager, then I've got, you know, my work cut out for me. But it does seem like there's sort of this balance or this pendulum swing that goes back and forth. And so it's important to be grounded and sort of take a step back from that and just sort of like, you know, understand that this too shall pass, and it's not worth taking going to these extremes too tightly. But you know, being able to have perspective, kind of like know that it's all balance, and it tends to balance itself out over time.
Yeah, I'm as one gets older, it's important to be present as much as possible, and to reduce stress levels and all these things. When I was, you know, 20 years ago, I could handle a lot of stress, whereas, you know, I'm over 50 now, and I do everything I can to get my head out of my phone. And in fact, even if I'm meeting up with somebody and I'm early at, say, maybe meeting at a bar, I don't look at my phone anymore. I look at the surroundings, because think about this, you know, 20 years ago, people didn't have phones. I mean, you did have a phone, but you'd play Snake on it. I mean, an old Nokia thing, and you could send text messages. And in fact, I was having this conversation with my wife the other day. Is that when I went through university, this was pre-mobile phone. No one had a mobile phone. And how did you meet up with people? And I was thinking, this is really weird. You'd actually arrange to meet somebody at a bar, and then you would go there and you would actually meet with them, and you couldn't ring them if you were going to be late. You couldn't text them. No one had mobile phones, but you still managed to do it. And you got there. And when you got there early, you'd look around the bar and you'd look, you know, if you're in a cafe, you'd look at the actual surroundings. And I would argue most people these days weren't, if you ask them what the inside of their favorite cafe or their favorite bar looks like, what are the color of the walls? They couldn't even tell you. Because they don't look at it. Because as soon as they get into the place, they're on their phone. The person they're with goes to the toilet. What do? We bring the phone out and we're checking whatever social media, your email, and it's. I don't think it's actually good for us. And in fact, I think there are quite a few studies coming through at the moment that are proving that it's actually not very good for you. So I do this now when I'm meeting up with people. Not allowed to have a mobile phone out. It never comes out of my pocket. I have it there if someone needs to call me if there's an emergency. But otherwise, don't have a look at. And then you look at the architecture and you look at the interior design and you look at the paintings on the walls. Paintings. Have a look at a painting. It's really interesting. It don't need to do it through your phone. Anyway, this is an old fart talking now. This is a boring old guy who plays vinyl and went to university before mobile phones were invented. But I think there's something to it. And, you know, the happiest you feel is when you get out in nature. And I say we have an all hands meeting every week and with the team. And I always finish it with, please get outside. If it's sunny, get outside, go for a walk, go for a 2-hour walk during the middle of the day and leave your computer and your phone behind and just go for a walk if it's sunny. No one will ever criticize you, because when you get back, you'll feel grounded, you'll feel happy, and you'll be wanting to engage with work again. And nothing will happen in the world during that 2 hours that you can do anything about, to go and enjoy yourself. And the guys do. And I think it's really important. And anyway, I don't know how we got to this, but I'm not preaching about put your mobile phone down.
I really appreciate you sharing that. I think this is important. And I also at night, I purchased a lockbox for my phone that it goes in at like 9 o'clock because of exactly what you're describing. I noticed a tendency to at night, especially when my like willpower is down, like I would end up being on my phone in my bed and like scrolling, and man, it's addictive. It's extremely addictive, and it's hard. Even though I don't [S2] Yeah. [S1] Like, you don't necessarily feel great after you do it. It's like, you know, a lot of money and a lot of AI has gone into like figuring out how to hijack the human brain and to hit those dopamine centers. So I think it is really important to have that reminder to be present and show up. And to be able to disconnect and remember who you are, you know, aside from this fast moving, you know, digital space. So it definitely has zoomed a bit out into like philosophical territory, but I appreciate it. I think it's really important. And it's part of the role that we play as musicians is sort of like reminding people of who they are, the communities, bringing them together and coming back, you know, to these kinds of real experiences. So appreciate you sharing that. And also thank you so much again for coming on the podcast today. This has been a really fun conversation. And you know, for anyone that is listening or watching this right now, who's interested in connecting more, what's the best place for them to go to reach out or dive deeper?
If you go to our website and if you want to create an account, we've got all various tiers that you can, so you know, various levels of pricing depending on what you want. What I will say is that we have a fantastic web designer who I would happily have build a store for anybody. So because having a really good looking storefront makes a huge difference. Conversion is everything with e-commerce. And so if you've got a very, you know, if you've got a storefront that looks a bit crappy and looks amateur, people get a bit nervous and they don't want to part with their cash. Whereas if you've got something that looks professional, then they will part with their cash. So we'll happily knock something together. I mean, we're not going to build a theme from scratch, but, you know, we'll say, do you want it to look a bit like Metallica's store? Or do you want it to look like Bryan Adams? Or do you want it to look, you know, a K-pop store that we do? Or, you know, so we'll give a few options and you provide the content and my designer will then build a store for you if you've got an account with us. And we'll do that for free for anyone who's listening to the podcast. To contact us, just do that through support. So support@musicblue.com and the guys are being alerted to this and they'll know what to do.
All right. Fantastic. So like always, we'll put the links in the show notes for easy access. And Mark, thank you again for coming on the podcast and talking a little bit about how things have evolved over the past couple of decades in the music industry and how to, you know, stay grounded in a quickly moving world with technology.
Cool. Thanks for having me, Michael.
Hey, this is Michael, and I just wanted to say thank you for tuning in to this episode of the podcast. I hope you found it really valuable, and if you did, if you want to share the word, we really appreciate you leaving a 5-star review on the podcast channel. If you want to learn more about the guest, you can check out the show notes for the links. And before you go, I wanted to remind you that I'm looking for new artists to mentor personally. Before we get started, we always offer a free 30-minute coaching call to make sure it's a good fit before you get your campaign launched. At this point, the artists that we've worked with have hit over 561.3 million streams, a number one album on iTunes, and have helped many artists grow from scratch to making a full-time income with their music online. In a few rare cases, they've even been able to generate $1 million per year with their music. That being said, we are very selective with who we work with, just based on who's the best fit and who we can best serve. And because we have a limited amount of time available for those free sessions, we do require an application process where you can submit your music and you can apply for a free coaching call with our team. So if you're interested, go ahead and click on the link in the show notes to submit an application, share one of your songs. We look forward to checking out your music, and we'll see you in the next episode.